I decided I would try to understand things psychologically, because it seemed to me that the current wisdom that people were acting as rational actors operating in their best socioeconomic and power interests didn't actually fit the facts. Many people and communities were doing things that were harmful to themselves. And I thought, well, one profession that spends a lot of its time exploring why individuals and indeed communities do things that harm themselves rather than operating in their best interest is psychiatry and indeed psychoanalysis. So I went into medicine and qualified in medicine and then in psychiatry. And in the later part of my time in psychiatry training, went into analysis and tried to explore individual psychoanalytic work, but also group analysis, family therapy, any of the approaches that seemed to me that they would deepen an understanding.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Lord John Alderdice. Lord Alderdice is a psychiatrist with extensive psychoanalytic training, and he applied that training in his early career as a clinician where he worked with individuals, families, and groups. But later on, he became very involved in the political arena and helping large groups struggle with each other productively. In fact, he played a significant role in negotiating the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. And he went further in his political work. He became the first speaker of the new Northern Ireland Assembly. He was appointed by both the British and the Irish governments to be one of four international commissioners to monitor security normalization and close down the illegal paramilitary activities in Ireland. In 1996, he was appointed to the House of Lords, and we have a discussion about what it means to be a Lord. I hadn't known the details of it. It's quite interesting. For many years, as I said, he was a clinician in Belfast, and he established the Center for Psychotherapy. He's now retired from clinical work. He is a senior research fellow at Harris Manchester College at the University of Oxford, and he's the director of the Center for the Resolution of Intractable Conflict. And that's the focus of our conversation today. He truly applies psychoanalysis off the couch. He is deeply thoughtful about how one manages negotiations. And in addition to being well thought out, as you'll hear, he's also very warm-hearted, which undoubtedly is of great help in the process of bringing bitter enemies to the negotiating table. I learned a great deal. I'm sure you will, because there are very few people in the world who can do what he does. And here is my conversation with Lord Alderdice. John, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here.
Thank you very much.
John, you have spent a great deal of your professional life at the negotiating table, literally and metaphorically. And I mean that to indicate you weren't there as a political scientist observing the phenomena. You were in the negotiations. And you were in the negotiations among antagonists who each felt they had their gods on their side, who each thought differently than the other party and didn't even know they were thinking differently. Each had deeply felt large group affiliations where a sense of humiliation was right beneath the surface. And also, you were sitting in negotiations where there were third parties who weren't present that had influences that had to be taken account of. And in each of these situations, you crucially brought your psychoanalytic mindset to the work. The best way I know how to introduce your thinking is to read from the first sentences of a chapter you've written, a chapter that will be in the podcast notes and which I highly recommend. It's called Off the Couch and Round the Conference Table, from a book called Off the Couch, Contemporary Psychoanalytic Applications, edited by Lema and Patrick in Routledge Publications. And you write, quote, "It was, at least in part, the struggle to find a more persuasive way of understanding the communal conflict where I was growing up in Northern Ireland, which led me to psychoanalysis. The political explanations, which were current at the time amongst intellectuals, answered my questions no more satisfactorily than the attitudes of the people on the streets, who similarly understood the problem as a struggle between good and evil, though the intellectuals couched it in more sophisticated terms." Close quote. John, tell us about this. What is it like to engage opponents using a psychoanalytic perspective?
Well, everybody who gets involved in politics comes to it for a reason. And a very large proportion of those who come into politics do so because they want to make things better for their own community, for the community as a whole. There's a great deal of skepticism about politics and politicians. But while some of it is justified, in other cases, it's not actually a proper response because many people come in with the wish to make things better. And that was why I came into politics. I was growing up, coming into my teens when things were breaking down into violence in Northern Ireland again in the 1960s, the late 1960s. And I thought, there must be some better way. This can't be the best way for us to live. And so other people will have looked around and said, well, as a young lawyer, I could do this, or a young business person, or whatever. I decided I would try to understand things psychologically, because it seemed to me that the current wisdom that people were acting as rational actors operating in their best socioeconomic and power interests didn't actually fit the facts. Many people and communities were doing things that were harmful to themselves. And I thought, well, one profession that spends a lot of its time exploring why individuals and indeed communities do things that harm themselves rather than operating in their best interest is psychiatry and indeed psychoanalysis. So I went into medicine and qualified in medicine and then in psychiatry. And in the later part of my time in psychiatry training, went into analysis and tried to explore individual psychoanalytic work, but also group analysis, family therapy, any of the approaches that seemed to me that they would deepen an understanding. Now, one of the most challenging issues when you get involved in working in a conflict is to find a way of not identifying with one side or the other. It's very difficult. In Northern Ireland, obviously, it was a challenge for me. I came from a Protestant Unionist background, although my parents always tried to explore things from the other perspective, and that was very helpful to me. But I think it's true in Israel-Palestine. It's true between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. It's true in Cyprus. When you get involved, it's very difficult to not identify more with one part of the community than the other. And when you do that, you simply become part of the problem.
You mentioned something in passing, but it's really quite striking that your father, while belonging to one of the sides, was always interested in not only thinking along his way, his side's way of thinking, but also to see it through other people's eyes. That's no small matter. I mean, that is a foundation for what a therapist, clinician, psychoanalyst comes to do. So you had that in you from an early point in your life.
Absolutely. And some of it came from the fact that he grew up on a small farm near to the border. So that business of border experience, all the concern about the future of the country, relationships between Protestants and Catholics and so on, what was there. Now, for some people, that meant they developed a greater understanding of the other side. For others, they became part of the conflict. And I remember asking him about it and saying, well, you know, you try to understand the other side. Oh, he said, there was that kind of attitude in the family. My father, that's to say his father, when he would go down to the market, there would always be some character standing up and speaking, you know, in a way that was not the usual. He'd go and listen to the communist, or he'd go and listen to somebody who was representing a totally different perspective. Not necessarily because he agreed with it, he usually didn't, but because he was interested to know. And then there would be great arguments and debates and discussions. And of course, I was lucky because when I went to church and we came back home for Sunday lunch, I could argue with the preacher about his sermon. I could say, well, I don't agree. Why did you say that? That doesn't make any sense to me. My poor mother just
wanted
to have a
lesson. Just to make clear, your father was the preacher. Your father was the preacher. Yeah, yeah, right.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And, you know, and actually, we enjoyed this debate and discussion. My mom just wanted a quiet Sunday lunch, really. Because she but her influence was enormously important as well, because she was a very caring person, and she involved herself in the church in trying to help people who were in difficulties and so on. That was her whole approach, was not about, you know, theology and all of that kind of stuff. It was about people and people in difficulties and how could help. And she spent her life basically doing that. So she was a really important part of the influence on me as well as him.
So that brings you to be interested in using the psychoanalytic lens to immerse yourself in these terrible, seemingly intractable struggles. Mm. And how did you then get into it? I mean, lots of people could think that they want to do that, but here you are, you trained in medicine, psychiatry, you did psychoanalytic training. What then?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, because it's a challenging thing. Some people get involved as pundits, advisors, people that write about things. One of the things about my psychoanalytic training, my training analyst, a man called Tom Freeman, who was a very close friend and colleague of Anna Freud's all his professional life, worked with her in the Hampstead Child Therapy Clinic, then came over to Northern Ireland. And he always used to say, you know, you can believe whatever you like unless you get involved with the patients. Once you start listening to the patients really seriously, then all sorts of things emerge that challenge your perspective. But, you know, you can believe whatever you like if you don't actually listen to the patients. And that had a big impact on me, because I thought, you know, he's right. If you don't actually get involved, then you can think whatever you like. So I thought, well, what that means is I think I need to get involved in politics. I need to get involved in it in a way which does not fall onto one side of the argument or the other, but it needs to actually be involved and engaged. Because if I do that, then I can engage with the political leaders in principle. And so I wrote to the various political parties, got back material from them, and decided that there was one party that was appropriate because it had both Protestants and Catholics, people from unionist and nationalist backgrounds. It was called the Alliance Party, and the name says it all. It was about building bridges or alliances between people on the different sides for the purpose of finding a peaceful resolution to our problems. And I thought, that's a suitable therapeutic stance for me. And so I joined the party. And it became clear to me after a little while that if you got to be the leader of the party, or at least senior in the party, then you had much more opportunity both of influencing how the party approached things, but also of engaging with the other politicians, particularly political leaders. It wasn't a particularly large party. It tended to be sort of between 5 and 10% of the vote. but it was able to engage with others, particularly if they felt you had something interesting to say. So I made it my business over a few years to become more senior in the party and eventually become elected the leader of the party, and then to contact British government, Irish government, the two prime ministers, go to see them, contact the leaders of the various political parties. And I think actually there was a certain amount of curiosity about this psychiatrist who'd come into politics. And what on earth was he about? And this was not the usual kind of route into politics. And so they were prepared to meet with me. And after we had the first meeting and I was able to engage with them, it proved easier to have meetings subsequently because they realized that this was a slightly different kind of conversation that they were having. And it wasn't a threatening one and it was potentially interesting. And for me, the agenda was then to build up a network of relationships amongst the different parties to try to move us from the position we were in at the time when I became leader, which was a deep polarization, violence, of course, but very little in the way of serious conversations going on with the two governments and the other political parties. The unionists were deeply disenchanted, not just with the Irish government, but with the British government. And so there were no serious talks going on at that stage. So for me to build up the network of connections and have conversations with people and then intervene in the public domain. Whenever you're seeing a patient, you listen to them, you hear what they have to say, and then you can simply make an intervention. You can say something. Well, of course, you can't do that in public life because the community has to have some reason to listen to you. And so a political platform gave one the opportunity to make interventions in the press, on radio, on television. And again, I think because the interventions were a bit different from what people were used to, the press and pundits got quite interested in it. So I got actually really quite a lot of airtime, which also strengthened my position in the public domain.
Let me ask you something about, again, something you've just said in passing. You've built up a network of connections. Now, my understanding from reading your work is that that is central to your approach that, tell me if I have this right, is puts you in a different position than politicians who also have connections, but that your networking and your focusing on the importance of relationships it is part of your psychoanalytic way of thinking and approaching this problem. Do I get that right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And indeed, as time has gone on, I have become more and more persuaded of the importance of relationships, not just individual human relationships of people with each other, but the relationships of communities with each other, large group relations in that sense. And right down to the really very fundamental levels where we talk about complexity and complexity science and complex adaptive systems, they are about the relationships of particles with each other. And these relationships are not steady, stable relationships. They're always in flux. They're always on the move. And it's exactly the same thing with human relationships, with the relationships of communities. If you think you've got a relationship sorted, it's already in trouble. Because it's not something you can have sorted. It's a dynamic thing that you have to work with all of the time. And so this is the approach that I would take, whether with individual politicians or people in government, civil servants and so on, or whether trying to understand the set of relationships between large communities, between Protestant Unionists and Catholic Nationalists, between Britain and Ireland, between North and South, within the European context, with the United States and the Irish-American community there, but also other communities. And this is not just true of my approach to Northern Ireland. It's also true when I've worked in other places, in the Middle East, in Latin America, in South Asia, and so on. It's because it's all about people and their relationships. And that's, for me, the central feature.
There are many glimpses into the negotiating process that you've shared in your writing. One of the things that caught my eye was you appreciate that aggressiveness, both verbally and also the action, the violence, is often used defensively to hide things as opposed to just to express things. That seems like a vital understanding that changes one's orientation, both in the clinical situation in the office and also outside of it. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. when you see a politician being angry, frustrated, giving out about things, of course you think about the fact that this is a person who's in power, they have a position of authority, and you can feel cross about that and say, you know, that they're trying to exert their influence in an unjustifiable way. And of course this is not often true. But when you're in a situation of conflict, this person is representing in their very personality the community from which they come, and of course in many cases they are an elected representative for that community. And when they express anger about things, sometimes it's because the community they represent actually feels under serious threat. They will, for example, perhaps believe that their future as a community, the culture, sometimes their language or their set of beliefs, their way of being in the world as a community, may be under threat, that there are serious challenges to it. And of course, that was the case in Northern Ireland. The unionist community felt under threat because there was an increasingly large Catholic nationalist community within Northern Ireland. There was a state to the south in the island, which was for many years a largely Catholic nationalist state. They knew that Britain was not, in the long run, a dependable ally that would stand by them. It hadn't stood by others, so why should it stand by them? So they felt like orphans, really. They felt that they couldn't be sure that anybody would be there to protect them. And so they were on the lookout for trouble and would respond sometimes to things that genuinely were a threat, and sometimes to things that weren't and weren't meant to be. They would respond with anger. They wouldn't come out and say, we're frightened about such and such, and because right. That showed a degree of weakness, and that only adds to your difficulty. But of course, when a politician like Dr. Ian Paisley, for example, expresses things angrily, the natural response that one has is either to be angry back or to be rather frightened. But if one can understand that he, in his very personality, is representing the personality of the community from which he comes, and that it's a frightened community as well as an angry community, then that means that you start to make different kinds of interventions.
You write about that in this chapter. Let me read a few more sentences that take us further down this road. You write, quote, "Remaining faithful to the psychoanalytic posture is absolutely key. One element of this is the constant submission of one's thoughts and responses to internal scrutiny, trying to understand what is going on in one's own self and one's relationships. It also means seeing political life not as a mere power play, but as a more complex matter of relationships between individuals, groups, and communities." That's how you listen. And I can only imagine that strikes people around the table as novel and refreshing, if not peculiar.
I think that's right. I mean, one expression of the anxiety that I was just mentioning there now is that when we came to the conference table with the British government, the Irish government, and the various Northern Ireland parties that were part of the talks at that stage, one of the first questions, there were a number, but one of the first questions was, what would be the order of speaking? And that was interesting because you might imagine that everybody would want to have the first word, or the last word, perhaps. But in truth, there was clearly a degree of anxiety around. And one of the things that relieved that anxiety was when it was suggested that we operate in alphabetical order. And because my party was the Alliance Party, it always came first. And the rest were quite content that I would start off because they would see how would it go with me if I got gobbled up by the rest. Well, then that was a warning. If, on the other hand, it worked out okay and the atmosphere was all right, and then they could afford to intervene as well. But what it did for me was it gave me the opportunity to intervene and say things that set the scene and perhaps sometimes would make an interpretation that would open things up a little bit. So, for example, there was a lot of criticism of all the politicians, people in the press and in the community were saying, these people aren't serious, they're not genuine, they're just playing games, none of them's really prepared to reach an accommodation, they never have in the past, they're never going to now. And so there was this kind of very negative attitude about people coming into the talks. And so I started off saying, well, we have a common problem as we come here from very different perspectives and representing different views. And the problem we have is that the press, and we all came in past the press on our way into the conference hall, the press and the people that they speak to are all very suspicious that we're just messing them about, that we're not really serious. And of course, there is a danger for us, a very real danger, because if we engage in this process and do not reach an agreement, then we are going to be betraying our children and our children's children. There may be some of us who are very fearful of betraying the past, betraying all of those who have been attacked, suffered, died, and that's a very reasonable concern. But which is going to be the most important for us? To not reach an agreement because we're being faithful to the past, or to take the risk of reaching an agreement so we do not betray our children in the future? Now, the point about that was it was helping to set a scene where all of us had a very genuine and relatively similar problem, a real reason for being anxious, whether we moved forward or didn't move forward. We were in a dilemma. And to say to people, and of course, if you look at it from a more instrumental point of view, by demonstrating that we together had a common problem as over against those outside the room, who are taking a different perspective, when one was creating a sort of element of camaraderie. I wouldn't like to overclaim on it, but nevertheless, a kind of sense that we are together in this dilemma and faced by those outside who are very suspicious of us.
Well, you were borrowing the us-them model that people came in with. You were just changing who was on which side. The them were the media, and it sounded like it worked. But let me ask you a question about getting to talks, because something you write about that really interested me is it's the importance of talks about talks. And I was reminded, I grew up in the era of the Vietnam War and Vietnam talks. And I recall very clearly that during the peace negotiations, there were endless debates about the size of the table and the shape of the table and who would be at the table. And at the time, lacking any understanding of what this was, it seemed foolishness, especially as people were dying while this was being negotiated. After reading your work, I came to understand it better, that these really are central issues that reflect culture's history and eventual outcomes of negotiations. Is that a fair characterization of it?
It is indeed. And there's also another element to it, which is that it's very frightening and troubling, and frankly, it's dangerous when you get involved in these talks processes. Because if you get involved and they break down, then you may get blamed for that. You raise people's hopes and then you dash them. So it's a risky business. And you don't know whether these people that you're working with are people that you can really get on with. And you can't start off trusting them. People very often say, oh, well, you know, it won't work if you don't start off with some trust. Well, of course, you can't start off with trust. When people have been killing each other, you'd be crazy to be trusting. So you've got to start off very gently feeling your way into it to try to see, is this somebody that I might be able to work with and engage with? Are they able to bring their own people with them to any degree? Because even if I get on with them as an individual, unless they can bring their people with them, there's no point in the thing at all, unless I can bring my people with me. And of course, there's not just two sides. There's many sides in all of this. So you very delicately and gently explore all sorts of practical issues, as you say, what shapes the table. And of course, what shape the table is and who is there also represents all sorts of power issues. Who's excluded? Who is a senior position? Who doesn't? If you bring yourself into talks in a position where you are very powerless, it may be very difficult to change that. So there all of these negotiations, these talks about talks, although they're very frustrating to people outside, and they may or may not be a genuine engagement, even in the most genuine engagements, they are absolutely necessary prerequisites for a full engagement. And as you say, during the process, you can also begin to understand the things that are important in the history and background. I'll give you one example. When we were asked at the talks table, one of the Catholic nationalist representatives, Seamus Mallon, who was the deputy leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party, got very angry one day. And we were sitting around this rather large table. And he banged the table and he said to the British Secretary of State, "Paddy," he said, which was in itself interesting. It was Sir Patrick Mayhew. But of course, to call him Paddy was in a way to engage with him and at the same time disrespect him in the way that he felt he was disrespected of such a Paddy, he said, "I don't suppose you know how I feel sitting at this table." And Sir Patrick Mayhew said, "Well, no, Seamus, I don't." He said, "Well, I'll tell you," he said. "This table came from a castle near to where I was brought up. And every day I would watch this young woman coming past our little house to go up to the castle where she would be serving at this table as a young Catholic woman. That's how I feel coming to this table." Well, that was an extraordinarily powerful statement, but it was also a deep insight for all of us into how he felt culturally, personally, in the talks process. And of course, was a very moving thing for everybody around the table, because he was in it, in his feelings. It wasn't some intellectual thing. It wasn't some mere political argument. It was a profound insight into how he felt. So when you're in talks, even talks about talks, this is the sort of thing that can emerge if you are able to create the context where it emerges.
Now, I imagine there are limits to possibilities. And when one party starts off with the conviction, assumption, and plan that their goal, however much they may engage in talks, their goal is to destroy the other, not to negotiate with the other, not to ultimately come to some compromise of collaborativeness, but to wipe the other off the face of the earth, then negotiations aren't possible? Is that how that works?
Well, I mean, sometimes negotiations aren't possible. That's true. And sometimes negotiations aren't possible at that time. Nelson Mandela was in prison for a very long time and things changed and he was able to come out and do extraordinary things in South Africa. But that wasn't because he himself suddenly got a bright new idea. It was because the wider context changed. The end of the Cold War meant that the relationship of the Soviet Union to the ANC and the relationship between the American government and other governments in the West to the South African government changed. So the external context changed, and that made a different kind of engagement possible. So sometimes it's not possible at a particular time, and then the context changes. But also, these processes can become quite powerful in themselves. And I remember talking with some colleagues in South Africa. Nelson Mandela had actually brought quite a number of us from the different parties out to, and not to tell us what to do, but to say, "Look, we tell you the story of our experience, and if it's any interest to you, any use to you, you're very welcome to it." And one of the things that we learned from one of the people on the white right in South Africa, he warned some of the people on the right in our situation, some of the quite right-wing Protestant Unionists, he said, "You need to understand these processes can become much more powerful than you." And when you enter into them, you may find that although you entered in with a particular agenda, by the time you come out, it's a very different agenda. And I think that was true of most of the parties that came into the talks. I don't think Sinn Féin went into those talks with the intention that they would come out with Martin McGuinness, one of the most senior IRA figures of the 20th century, ending up as a minister of the Queen, which is actually what happened. He didn't intend that at all. And I don't think that the unionists went in with the intention of ending up in government with Sinn Féin. They intended to end up with a more moderate SDLP. So the dynamic can be really very powerful. Of course, it doesn't move smoothly. There are lots of breakdowns, and we had breakdowns, some of them occasioned by very predictable political problems, elections. They're always a risky time. People say all sorts of things. We had elections from time to time during the process, and we had to try to engage, if possible, in advance to make sure that the election didn't destroy the possibility of the talks. And sometimes there were serious rows. I remember situations where we had to confront loyalists on the one hand or Sinn Féin on the other hand because of the violent activities of their colleagues in the paramilitary organisations. And sometimes the talks, you know, broke down for a period of time, sometimes quite some substantial period of time. But when you picked up, you didn't start all over again. You picked up, if not quite from the point where you'd left it, certainly with a lot of the progress that had been made, able to be rescued and sometimes reframed a little bit and taken forward.
It's analogous to the clinical situation where there are always disruptions, predictably. In fact, if there aren't, then something isn't being engaged. We always have to be surprised that actions and acting out and acting in is part of the process, and each step needs to be unpacked, understood, and integrated into the process so that it remains and moves forward in a richer way.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I've seen situations myself. You know, I was a psychiatrist and psychotherapist for quite a long time. And I saw situations myself where somebody came along to see me, maybe we had one or two sessions, then they stopped coming. And then some years later, they contacted me and came back and were able to pick up. And even since I stopped my clinical work, I still from time to time will get a letter from someone who I was treating, asking me a question, and I make a response, hopefully a helpful response, sure, if I can. So there's something continuing on there. And so you're absolutely right. The same thing happens in the political situation. And one of the disadvantages of having long-running political leaderships is that they very often mean there's not fundamental change. But one of the advantages of some people being around in politics for quite a long time in these intractable conflicts is that they can pick things up again. They do know some of the people. They understand there is an institutional memory of talks that enables one to move forward. And when that is lost, then that is quite a problem. And sometimes it can be lost during the process, but sometimes it can be lost after you've finished up, you've got an agreement, people think it's all sorted, and the next generation forgets what had to be done to get an agreement. And there's a little bit of that in Ireland, North and South at the moment. And that's something that we have to be careful about.
Are people used to having the psychiatrist as the politician? I assume when you first did this, you were the butt of jokes and discomforts and all the kind of comments clinicians get out in the outside world about, you know, you're going to read my mind and we certainly need a psychiatrist around here. How were you received personally? And how has that changed over time?
Well, I think in the first instance, there was a degree of curiosity. I mean, I was quite young when I got involved in all of this. I was about 32 whenever I became the leader of the party. So I was quite young. So there was quite a lot of interest. Not a lot of change. The troubles had been going on for quite some time. And quite a lot had stayed the same in terms of leadership of parties and all of those kinds of things. So somebody new on the block was a kind of interesting thing. And they were relatively young, that was interesting. And they curious ideas about things. Just beside me in the office I'm in here at present, there's a cartoon of myself, which was drawn by the leading cartoonist of the time with a couch and Ulster, the map of Ulster lying on the couch and me sitting beside it with a notebook and one of Freud's books and one of Jung's books up behind. You know, so there was this kind of sense of Ulster on the couch, as it were. So there was that. There were those who were, I mean, genuinely suspicious of me. You know, what is this guy thinking? There were other colleagues who actually had their own emotional problems and were keen to sit down and have a chat about them, get a free consultation, as it were. I have to be a little bit careful about that kind of thing. But as time went on and people began to see who I was as a person, it actually became a very positive thing. People would say, well, you know, he has a different perspective on things and I think he's pretty genuine and he is able. Then when I went on to be not the leader of the party but the speaker of the new assembly after the agreement, and people could see the therapeutic context of the speaker who was there trying to hold this disparate, feuding body of politicians together to do something positive and good. And, you know, broadcast every day and people could see it and so on. So as time went on, I think people began to feel, well, maybe this was a useful thing. And actually, as it happened, one or two other young psychiatrists got involved in politics as well with me in the Alliance Party. And some of them are still involved and making useful interventions about anxiety in politics, about how violence affects things, about the fact that people who use violence are mostly not mentally ill at all, but there are other things going on, and so on. So I think people began to value it. And certainly, as time went on, I wasn't dismissed for it at all. One thing I did have to be careful about was the impact of being a public figure on the work that I was still doing with some patients. And that was a clinical challenge that I had to work with. And indeed, in fairness, my patients had to work with as well, because, you know, they would see me on the news or making comments and so on. Now, if I had been working as a partisan politician, if I'd been representing one side of the community or another, then I think it probably would have been impossible to continue any kind of clinical work. But because people saw the work I was doing in politics as kind of psychoanalysis on the larger scale, if you like, it was possible in most cases for the patients to be prepared to accept that. As time went on, I became more preoccupied with the work, wasn't able to see people as often, and therefore moved more to providing supervision for other therapists who were doing the clinical work rather than seeing many patients myself. But even up to the time when I retired, when I was 55, I was still seeing some patients in psychotherapy.
Now, you are working not for the IPA, the International Psychoanalytic Association, but in affiliation with it. Tell us what that is. It seems so useful and fascinating.
Well, Harriet Wolff, whenever she was thinking about throwing her hat in the ring for the presidency of IPA, was thinking about what could usefully be done. It wasn't a question of what position could she have, but what could be done. What could IPA do that perhaps it hadn't been doing before? How could she provide some leadership? And she felt that the global context was deteriorating rapidly. Now, this is what, 3 or 4 years ago, maybe. But already it was very clear that things were not going at all well. And she felt that the IPA ought to be able to say something or intervene in some constructive way. And indeed, if one looks back to the period substantially before the Second World War, psychoanalysts were often consulted. I mean, famously, Freud, of course, was consulted by Albert Einstein on the question of war. But psychoanalysts themselves wrote quite a lot about it. The Second World War changed all of that enormously for various reasons. But Harriet felt that it should be possible to think about the wider geopolitical situation and provide some help or enlightenment from psychoanalysis. So she contacted me about this and said, look, do you think we could do something? I said, well, what would you like to do? And we actually met up at an airport. She was coming flying in and I was flying out. We met up in a coffee shop and spent an hour or more talking about this and thought, well, one possibility is that the IPA Congress is coming up before long in London. And maybe if she and I both contacted, maybe a dozen or more psychoanalysts who we know have an interest in this area and have been doing things, and there are a number that have been. For example, Bamik Volkan, of course, for many, many years has been working in this area and doing all sorts of useful things, writing books and papers and so on. Sver Varvin is another. On the group analytic side, Gabriel Rifkind. There are a number of people who have been working in this area. So we decided we would bring them together and we would spend 2 full days just shooting the breeze with each other, really, talking about what each of us was doing, what sorts of things were possible, see if anything would emerge from it. Nothing might come of it, something might come of it. But it was an independent group. It wasn't a subcommittee of IPA or any of those kinds of things. Anyway, we had a couple of days. We recorded them so that we could transcribe them afterwards and do something with it. And we felt, this is actually rather useful, but we need to develop a process through which we do this on a regular basis. And as time went on, and of course all of us moved to doing things on Zoom and MS Teams and so on, we continued this. And so it still continues. Harriet is now the president And I think she feels that what we're exploring enriches her approach and brings thoughts and ideas into the IPA, and all of us and a number of colleagues are members of IPA, are then enriched by our engagement with each other on these issues and can take them out and do something with them. So it's not as though the group itself, you know, writes papers or makes big interventions or these kinds of things, but it's an experience and engagement that enables each of us, including Harriet and other colleagues, to go out and do things within the IPA or, in the case of some of us, outside the IPA, enriched by that engagement with each other.
It sounds very promising and very exciting, both for the group and for the organization as a whole. Before we interrupt, I have to ask you a question as an American. It's about your title of Lord. I've never spoken to a Lord. I didn't know what a Lord was. Its only meaning to me was something awkward. It's sort of like that castle of that story. That was the image I had of the Lord. In our speaking, I've learned it's the reality is far from that. Can you give me and others of our listeners who are as unaware of its real meaning as I am, tell us what it means to be a Lord and how you receive that designation?
Right. Well, you have two chambers to your legislature, the House and the Senate. And we have two chambers too, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. So our House of Lords is the equivalent of your Senate. Your senators are elected, two from each of the states, on a regular basis. But our House of Lords has grown up over many hundreds of years. And when it started to emerge, of course, you didn't have elections. What you did have was a need for the king to be able to collaborate with the power brokers of the time. And you were a powerful person in those days if you had land, because if you had land, you had tenants who you could draw upon as soldiers to defend you, obviously people who would pay you. And so if the king wanted an army, or if the king wanted to raise taxes, he raised money for some venture or other, he needed to be able to work with these people who owned land. And you owned land in those days because land was given to you and was given to you by the king or the king's predecessors. And you were given a title of that land, of that territory. So my name is Lord Alderdice of Knock. And Knock is the area where I worked. Sadly, now we don't get the territory. We just get the title. But in those days, you got the territory. And of course, you might well build a castle to defend things. And your tenants would have a loyalty to you. You know, whether they liked it or not, they would have a loyalty to you. Well, of course, you could pass on your land, your castle, your title, the loyalty of your tenants to the next generation. So it was a hereditary arrangement. Now, that all worked through until the Industrial Revolution. And then you started getting people who were powerful, not because they controlled land, but because they controlled mining, or they controlled the presses, or they controlled businesses of various kinds. So you had these industrial barons, if you like. And, of course, they too could pass their wealth and power on to the next generation. So the hereditary principle still made sense. But when you came into the 20th century, it didn't make any sense anymore, because you had more and more a knowledge economy. And while you can hand on land, and you can hand on relationships, and you can hand on businesses, you can't hand on knowledge. And you can't really hand, for example, if you're a psychotherapist, or if you're an architect or a surgeon or an engineer, you can't pass that on to the next generation. So as time moved on into the 1950s, the House of Lords changed to be a house of people who were appointed for their lifetime, not able to be handed on. And that's now the position. There are still a few people who are there and their families have been there for some time. But the vast majority of members of the House of Lords are people who are appointed because of what they have achieved and what it is believed that they can contribute, and they're there for their lifetime, and they can't hand that on to the next generation. And the advantage of this is that you have people in the House of Lords who would never dream of standing for election because they're involved in the arts, or they've been involved in the military or civil service, or various other kinds of cultural activities, or people who have been in elected politics but no longer want to continue with that. And the second thing is they don't feel that they have any need to appeal to people on a partisan basis anymore. They're not standing for election. They're there without any salary, by the way. They get an expense for coming each day. And if they're not there, they don't get anything at all. They don't have any staff or anything. That's all, unless they pay out of their own pockets for it. But they come because they want to do something for the country and because they believe in what they're doing. And they give their time to that. So it is like your Senate, but it's constructed in a different way. It has a different history, and it has both advantages and disadvantages of a non-elected chamber. And I've been there now for 25 years. This is actually the 25th anniversary of my going into the House of Lords. And I was appointed by the Queen. All peers are appointed by the Queen, but on the recommendation of the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister at the time was John Major, and he put my name forward with encouragement from some other colleagues who felt I could make a useful commitment. I've been involved in Northern Ireland, of course, but I've been involved in international politics in various ways too, and it was felt that I could make a useful contribution to debates, to arguments, and to be a useful representative for Northern Ireland.
John, let me read a sentence. You write, this task demands intellectual effort because the language of the clinical setting requires translation if it is to be acceptable in the political world. It is not appropriate to speak politically in the language of the clinic. I say that because listening to you, you do something really quite special. That is, you think like an analyst, but you talk like a person and you talk like a politician in the best sense of the term. You talk about somebody who mixes it up with people, but without using the lingo and the jargon of your background, you utilize it in your manner of being and in your way of engaging, which I'm sure has a great deal to do with why you're successful.
I think it's a really important thing to do, Harvey. I think it's very important for people to do in clinical work as well, that you have to find a way of engaging with the client or patient in a language and in a way of being that they understand. If you start using technical terms, then it turns it into some other kind of an exercise. It's an intellectual exercise. It's not an engaging emotional relationship. So it's important even in the clinical context. But of course, it's in a sense important to another power when you come into politics, because the last thing that you want is for people to be alienated by the kind of language that you use. What you need to find a way of relating with them, engaging with them. And when you engage in that exercise of translation, really, from one way of thinking to another way of engaging and being, it's extremely helpful to oneself, because you really have to struggle to make sure you know. It's like the business of teaching. The best way of learning is to teach, because you especially if you're prepared to allow your students to ask you questions, because they will ask you questions that will probe and push you, and then you've got to say, well, wait a minute, I need to think about that. I'm just coming off with a bunch of words here. I need to actually understand what I'm talking about. And the best way of doing that is actually to be able to use another set of words to describe it, not just to take a set of words that you've learned from somebody else, although sometimes quotations can be helpful, but as far as possible to internalize it, to take it right into yourself so that you have a sense of what it is you're trying to do, and then find your own words and not just descriptions. I find that telling stories is often very helpful. You know, Freud realized this and developed the whole business of case histories, which are totally fascinating for people to read. Jesus did this. The parables were stories. And by telling them, he got people to understand a little bit of what he was trying to say. And I find that when I'm talking with other politicians, I will often make reference. Sometimes I will even make reference to psychological things. I'll say something like, well, you know, all of us are involved in families, and we know what this is like. And it has got various kinds of challenges. And you might use an example from family experiences or from the growing up of children or dealing with adolescents. You know, you might say something like, well, you know, whenever you're dealing with other political parties and a peace process, you know, it's a bit like adolescence. The first rule of working with adolescents is you're going to be wrong. Doesn't matter what you do, you're going to be wrong. But it doesn't stop you doing it. You try to engage in it. And people will then kind of smile and say, oh, yeah, I know what that's like. I've got a couple of teenagers myself. So that kind of digesting of the understanding and then using words and pictures and stories to convey it seems to me to be very important if you're going to actually get far with people. And if you're going to really know what you're doing yourself.
I'm smiling as you're saying it, because when you talk about people saying, I know what that's like, we've all had that experience. But what you communicate more is, of course, more than your words. It's how you live the words. And engaging with you is a very enlivening, deepening experience for me, you and I talking now. And so it is the words you say, but it's the life you live, going back to your father who said, yes, I have a point of view, but let's be interested in what the other person said. I can feel that in your bones. It comes across. And if it does to me, I'm sure it happens to the people you're negotiating with, to the advantage of all concerned, obviously, given the accomplishments you've been able to achieve. John, I want to thank you for spending this time with me and with us. It's been a pleasure to get to know you, both to get to know you and to read the things you've written. And I'm delighted that you have an affiliation with the IPA. I'm pretty sure we're going to be hearing more from you and your group, and we're all going to learn and bring our analytic skills, as the saying goes, off the couch. So thank you for sharing this with us.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Harvey. I've enjoyed it very much, as I always do, engaging with colleagues who are, like you, interested in this troubled and difficult world that we live in and what we can do to make it a better place. So thank you for the conversation, and I'm sure we'll get a chance to chat again before too long.
I look forward to it. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.